I'm going to call this
facing
meeting.
Facing a flag.
All right. I'm going to call this meeting to order. Welcome to the March 3rd, 2018 commission meeting of the Central Marin Sanitation Agency. Could we, would you all please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. Before we call the roll, I would like to make clear for the record of this meeting, and it should be reflected in the minutes, that a portion of this CMSA board meeting is being conducted pursuant to California Government Code Section 54953, in that Commissioner Borstein of Ross Valley Sanitary District is in San Diego and is participating by speakerphone. In accordance with the Ralph M. Brown Act, the teleconference has been identified in the notice and agenda for this meeting. So, could we please call the roll?
Oh, sure. Commissioner Burst?
Here.
Doug Kelly?
Here.
Mary Beth Bushy? Not yet.
Is somebody walking up?
Oh, okay. Dean DiGiovanni?
Here.
Michael Borstein?
I am here.
And Doug Kelly?
You did me.
Oh, I did.
Dan Hilmer.
And Dan Hilmer, sorry.
Present.
Thank you. Okay, got everybody.
Thank you. First up is open time for public participation. This is a time where members of the public can speak on anything not on tonight's agenda. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak? Seeing none, let's move on to the consent calendar. The purpose of the consent calendar is to pass routine items or items that have been discussed previously. They will be passed in a single motion unless any member of the board, staff, or the public would like to remove an item for discussion. Would anybody like to remove an item?
No.
Seeing none, I will entertain a motion for consent calendar items A through G.
So moved. Second.
Thank you. And we will be conducting votes tonight by roll call. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's right.
Would
yes.
you
okay.
be so kind?
Please? So, IRNA for the consent calendar. Diane Hurst?
Yes.
Yes. Dean DiGiovanni?
Yes.
Oops. Michael Borstein?
Yes, ma'am.
Doug Kelly?
Yes.
And Dan Hilmer.
Yes.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Because Mary Beth indicated that she would be a little bit late tonight, I would like to reorder the next couple of agenda items because I would like her to be here for agenda item number five. So I think we'll revisit number five and move on to number six right now, rescheduling the April 2018 board meeting. Jason.
So staff is, you know, requesting that the board reschedule the regular board meeting, which is on Tuesday, April 10th, just moving it 2 days to Thursday, April 12th. I checked in with all the board members except Commissioner Gaffney, and everybody was open on Thursday the 12th. So it would be a special board meeting in this room, 7 p.m., but we would get the agenda out the prior Friday like normal. And in the staff report, these are the tentative items that are planned right now for that April meeting.
Okay. Anybody want to comment or ask questions? Would any member of the public like to comment on this item? See none, let's bring it back and discuss until Mary Beth gets here.
We can move on to number seven. All right. We reschedule.
I have one comment. I may miss the meeting if I am strong-armed to go on a trip with my significant other.
Maybe out of the country.
Okay. You'd be out of the country on either date, right?
That week. Yeah.
Okay.
So that wouldn't matter.
Do you have an alternate that you might be able to, either of you?
I have an alternate.
Is that Katie?
Al?
No, she's Yeah, it's outdoor.
Look at that third
in line is.
Yeah, I think Katie's third in line.
Is there an alternate policy?
Oh, that's right, Katie Rice is.
Yeah, because she's in the center phone. Yep.
I think
Larkspur.
Kate.
You're Kate currently Larkspur's
alternate.
So Larkspur didn't appoint a regular member. They're just relying on you to serve in both capacities.
So the AAA farm team is the next.
I could do a call in if I was not going to be here, since Mike is educating me right now.
Okay.
Sure, I can do a call in.
Okay. Yep. You may want to look at the board members and alternate lists, because it's got Dan as the alternate for Larkspur.
Mm-hmm.
And in Sanitary District Number 1, I'm the alternate. We had one alternate. We went from having everybody be an alternate to having me be the alternate.
Okay. All right.
Should I?
Katie's your third.
Okay. Let's do this one at a time. So,
I thought you wanted to talk for a while.
Dan.
Should I make a mayoral appointment right now and change myself to the.
Maybe at your next meeting. What do you think? Would you like Larkspur to kind of come up with a primary and an alternate?
That'd be helpful.
Do you think you guys would be willing to do that?
Yeah, and I can. You can write it down. It's done. We'll just do the paperwork.
Yeah. Good. Might not be a bad idea then, maybe a week and a half before the meeting to ensure we're likely to have a quorum?
Definitely, I'll do that, sure.
Thank you. Okay.
So I move to reschedule meeting.
Thank you. Any member of the public like to speak to this? See none? Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. Roll call.
Dan first.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
Wasn't your turn.
Dan first?
Yes.
Dean DiGiovanni?
Yes.
Michael Borstein?
Yes.
Doug Kelly?
Yes.
And Dan Hilder?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's move on to agenda item number 7, financial audit services contract with Cooper Accountancy Corporation.
Okay, so Siobhan and Associates has been our financial auditing firm for about 6 years. And the last couple years, their agreement was a 4-year agreement with 2 separate 1-year extensions. And for each of those extensions, we checked in with the finance committee during kind of the draft budget review process. And just said just checked in to make sure it was okay with amending their contract for a year for another year's service, with the plan to go out through an RFP based selection process for FY19's audit. So the finance committee thought that was fine. So we've amended Siobhan's contract twice. So it's been for 6 years they provided the services. So we went through the standard process where we developed an RFP, we sent it to about 9. CPA firms that are in the San Francisco Bay Area that specialize in working with public agencies, in particular wastewater agencies or sanitary districts, sanitation districts, on the internal control audit, the financial audit, and so forth. And we reviewed proposals, evaluated them based on different types of criteria, weighted criteria, checked references, and we're recommending that the board authorize the agency contracting with Cropper Accountancy. Right now, they work with 5 different wastewater agencies in the Bay Area, one being Sanitary District number 2, another being Laurel Loma Sanitary District, West County Sanitary District. And Ken Spray kind of headed up the effort of preparing the RFP, doing the screening, and worked with his staff on that. And he did check in with all 5 agencies, who are his peers, the finance directors of those agencies, and they all had, great references for Cropper Accountancy. So they did fine work, they made schedules, and their fee is $18,500 each year with no escalator associated with that. So attached to the staff report is the professional services agreement with them with a scope of work, kind of a general scope of work, and we also reference their proposal, which has a much more detailed scope of work in it. So I can answer any questions.
Well, you've had Siobhan for 6 years. It seems appropriate to change after 6 years. How often do you typically change?
Prior to Siobhan, we had a firm which was a Vavrinic, Trine & Day, and we had them for about 8+ years.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, you know, we decided at that point that we're going to have a firm for 4 to 6 years. So that's why we kind of designed the 4-year contract with the 1-year extensions.
Yep.
And the state law was passed where you can use an auditing firm, but after 6 years, you have to have different principals involved and different staff that are doing the field work. So there's no state law that prohibits you to a certain time period. But we internally, and working with the finance committee, we thought, you know, 4 to 6 years seems proper.
I think that's right. I think you should change. So,
okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Let the record show that Mary Beth has arrived. Thank you.
7:15 on the dot.
Good.
Barry was on time.
We are on agenda item number 7. Is there anybody else who would like to ask a question or comment on this item? No?
I just have one question. This is going to be in addition to the auditor that we have for pension liability and that report we just went through a couple months ago.
Are you talking about the GASB 4575 or
yeah.
OPEB? Yeah, that's an actuary, okay. Not an auditor.
Right. Right.
And we're using a North Bay Pensions to do the actuarial evaluation. And that's happening right now. And probably at the April meeting, we'll have a presentation from North Bay Pensions, Nick Francis Kine, who's been preparing the GASB 45, you know, every 2 to 3 years, the required kind of revaluations of our unfunded liabilities on the OPEB side.
And does that feed into this, their audit?
The audit, there are notes in the audit that talk about the agency's GASB 75 unfunded liabilities, and those do have to be reported on your statement of net position.
They're pretty separate in terms of
in terms of the analyses. Yeah, the auditors will just take the GASB, it was the GASB 45 information. In the past, under GASB 45, if you paid or you've provided funding for your net annual required contributions, you didn't have to report a liability on your financial statements. But under GASB 75, you're going to have to report your full unfunded liability on the financial statements. So your net position will decrease. But the auditor just takes that information, you know, from the GASB 75 report.
They referred to that in the presentation, but it was a
Okay, would any member of the public like to speak to this item? See none, I will bring it back for any further discussion and or a motion.
I move the staff recommendation.
Second.
Thank you, and just to clarify, the staff recommendation is to approve the financial audit services contract with Crocker Accountancy Corporation. Thank you. Could we please have the roll?
Yes. Chair first.
Yes.
Mary Beth Bushy.
Aye. Yes.
Dean DiGiovanni.
Yes.
Michael Borstein.
Yes, ma'am.
Dan Hilmer.
Yes.
And Doug Kelly.
Yes.
Thank you.
Let's back up now and pick up on agenda item number 5, excess power sale options.
Okay, thank you, Chair first.
I hope you just had decided that.
Oh, no, we were waiting for you, Mary Beth. Couldn't do this without you.
Oh.
So there's a lot of information attached to the staff report. There's a lot of history on this item, so I'll kind of be brief. But a major, you know, initiative, multi-year initiative for the agency is kind of designing, implementing these various activities which ultimately will allow us to deliver power to the grid. And that's been written into our vision statement. It's in our fiscal year 18 business plan. We have a whole objective about implementing these various activities. And things have been going pretty well, you know, for the most part, in terms of moving things forward at the staff level anyways. So as you recall, we have a new interconnection agreement with PG&E. Part of that agreement is for CMSA to fund certain improvements to the PG&E distribution and transmission system, which, you know, we set up an escrow account, we moved the funds into those. PG&E's finished up the design work, they've scheduled the construction work, and that should be wrapped up in the next few months. There are some improvements that we have to make on our end in terms of some control system modifications, installing some new relays in our switchgear system. That's all been designed by Corolla engineers, and that's under review by PG&E right now. So by the summer, we should have our improvements completed, their improvements completed, and we should receive whatever form of formal authorization from PG&E that we can start delivering power, and we'll have a commercial operations deed associated with that. So that's been really positive, kind of slow moving, but it's close to getting finished up, so that's a good thing. Then we had to, then we reached out to the California Energy Commission to talk to them about the process we had to go through to be certified as a renewable power generator. And we learned from them that you have to have all the interconnection activities completed and that authorization from PG&E, and you have to have, you know, an arrangement with an entity to purchase your power. So based on that, we put the CEC work on hold until we have some type of power purchase arrangement, you know, set up. And on the power purchase side, you know, initially, you know, we received, you know, part of a bigger presentation from, you know, Mike Brown Engineering, Mike's here, back in July of 2016, which had the initial review of the different types of arrangements where CMSA could sell power. That's either directly to an entity, like Marin Sanitary Service, or it could be through a bill trans credit program, or it could be through a power purchase agreement with PG&E. There's a few different, you know, tariffs that were applicable to that, or through Marine Clean Energy. So we presented that to the board and kind of move forward with just further to review the different types of structures and kind of do our own screening to see which one would make sense. And in the staff report, I talk about a little on which ones made sense and which ones didn't. Ultimately, we came back to the board with, you know, the report on that additional work and received you know, direction from the board to negotiate with PG&E and MC for a power purchase agreement or a feed-in tariff, one or the other. So we started discussions with PG&E MC, and that led to a few things. One, that we learned we weren't eligible for their biomap program, which had the best, you know, feed-in tariff price at 12.8 cents per kilowatt hour. So then we refocused on MCE, came back to the board with the report of the work, and the board said, okay, go ahead and negotiate a contract with Marine Clean Energy. And the reason at the time for that was they had the highest, you know, feed-in tariff price that they'd pay for the power, and that they're, you know, a local public agency like us, and that we thought it would be pretty cool if we were a deep green energy provider and we were in their portfolio. And they said they liked that too. So based on those, that discussion, the board said, go ahead and negotiate with them. And that was back in May of 2017. So we reached out to Marine Clean Energy, informed with the board, you know, direction was the staff. We got a copy of their, what they call a small generator power purchase agreement. And that's part of a bigger power purchase program that the MC board approved back in 2012. And we reviewed it pretty, you know, pretty closely internally. Mike and his staff reviewed it. Our construction contract, you know, attorney Bill McInerney and one of his more specialized attorneys in their office reviewed it. We had lots of comments. We had lots of areas that we thought needed to be revised. There were sections that we thought should just be fully removed because they weren't applicable to CMSA. There was some of the modifications that we proposed to MCE. The MCE accepted some of those. They didn't accept quite a few of them. And they clarified a lot of things, explained what things meant and why they weren't going to take some of these provisions out. Some made sense, some didn't. Then back in October of last year, we brought that draft agreement to the board just to show you that we've been moving forward on this. And I summarized, you know, what the revisions were and where there were some clarifications to explain other provisions where they weren't going to remove that particular section. So at that board meeting, the board started looking at the agreement a little more closely and decided that, well, we probably need to take a much closer look at the agreement. So they formed, you know, an ad hoc energy committee, and that was Commissioner Bushy and DiGiovanni and Commissioner Gaffney. So from that October meeting until the end of our last board meeting, we've met, you know, a few times and spent, you know, a lot of good work reviewing all the terms of the agreement. In particular, all the operating provisions at the beginning of the agreement, not as much some of the more legal provisions at the back end of the agreement, reviewed definitions. And I think we had some really good conversations about, you know, where there are potential, you know, conflicting provisions, where there are things that didn't make sense, where there are some definitions where we could propose changes, overall, so we just had a tighter agreement that made sense for our arrangement, and like how we prepare our agreements agency, we make sure that they're foolproof and then they're sound and they make sense. So at the committee level, good conversation, a lot of good work. Then we went to MCE, at least three times, in a lot of conversations on the phone or by email, and they're great to talk with, real pleasant and friendly to us, but they weren't agreeable to make any other changes beyond what they had already accepted, prior to the October meeting where I brought the draft agreement to the board. And they had some reasons. A lot of it was, associated with, precedent setting, and if they did that for us, then there'd be future, clients that would want to make changes, then all of the other entities that they have the same contract with since 2012, they may want to make some changes, and they didn't want to enter that situation. So not a lot of good progress with MCE, but they did, they've clarified, additional things and said they're very interested in contracting with us, that they want to diversify their portfolio with, a wastewater agency that generates power utilizing biogas as the fuel. And then their, I guess the primary reason this is before the board tonight is that in our feed-in tariff application with MC, which we sent in about a year ago, and they accepted it, they had a date of March 20th of this year for us to complete a series of activities in the checklist. And we've made progress on a lot of those, but there's some things that we're just not going to get done, like all the PG interconnection work. And one of the checklist items is to execute the power purchase agreement. But there is a provision in the application that says you could request a 12-month extension as long as you're showing that you're moving, the whole process forward in terms of, completing these checklist items. And, we felt pretty good about that because we moved a lot of things forward, like I explained to you at the beginning of this what is called now a long presentation. But so our staff contacted MCE, said, hey, could we extend this for 12 months? Because, we're still talking about it internally and figure things out, and we're moving forward on interconnection and making improvements in our systems. And they said, we will extend it to 12 months, but you have to have the power purchase agreement approved by your board to get that extension. Then that will buy you the extra time to get all the other work done. So we reported this to the Energy Committee, on the February 13th meeting after the regular board meeting. Had a good discussion, with the committee again, and they said, well, why don't we just bring it to this board meeting tonight so the full board could to discuss it and vet it out. So the staff recommendation tonight, after you hear, Mike Brown's presentation, is to either decide if you want to contract with Marine Clean Energy or not. And if not, you could direct us to pursue something else. But if you decide you want to contract with Marine Clean Energy, then we need to select a term, either 10, 15, or 20-year term. So with that, I could introduce, Mike. And he, another thing that we've done concurrent with the Energy Committee work is that we've asked Mike to take a much closer, detailed look at each of the feed-in tariffs and agreements that are applicable and do economic analysis associated with those and also look at the pros and cons, of the key terms and provisions in the agreement, especially the ones that were identified by the committee as being, concerning. Okay, I'm wrapped up. I'm done.
Thank you.
So, Mike?
Thank you. You can get the PowerPoint in.
Is it going to go up here?
Yeah, right there. Okay. Can you turn it to a slideshow?
I hesitate to turn down the lights too low right after dinner. I'll try to keep you awake.
Cookies over here. It's a little on top. That's just on top. Oh, there you go.
It sounded so easy a couple of years ago when we first started talking about this project that you have some extra digester capacity, you've got a cogen engine that's running at less than full capacity. Under the new California laws, generators of food waste are required to find someplace like an anaerobic digester to use them, and it seemed really simple. And here we are a couple of years later, and we've maneuvered through a number of things which Jason reviewed for you through the California Energy Commission program, PG&E interconnection, and we're really at the last point. This is the last decision that you need to make before it will really happen. And food waste will go into your digester, more food waste than is going now. More electricity will be generated and sold to somebody. And the great news I have for you is you have three good choices in terms of what you where you decide to sell that. And the choices are partly financial, or the criteria for choosing, partly financial, partly technical, legal, businessy, and partly political. Because one of the three, as you know, is Marin Clean Energy, which is a community-based utility, and that has special connotations as well. So I want to start with defining something, because Jason spent a lot of time talking about how Marin Clean Energy wasn't willing to negotiate this and wasn't willing to negotiate that. And the reason is not that they're mean people or they're hard-nosed or anything. It has to do with the fact that both they and PG&E, the programs they have that you're eligible for, are what's called feed-in tariffs. And these are special programs allowed by the Public Utilities Commission, State Public Utilities Commission, for small renewable energy projects. And they're supposed to be administratively very simple. I would argue that they're maybe not quite so simple, but that's the idea. And because of that, and that point is that a small project typically cannot spend a lot of time and money on consultants and attorneys and accountants to negotiate from scratch a large power purchase agreement. So they say, here's our power purchase agreement, take it or leave it. And here's a price, take it or leave it, and you can take it or leave it. I'd have to say that in my experience, and Ryan and I are working with Southern California Edison and PG&E, as well as Marin Clean Energy on this project, they have really stretched that envelope in terms of what they are willing to negotiate, and I've been pleasantly surprised. One of the big ones was there was a fatal flaw in their criteria that said that because you had received a grant money through the SGIP program, you weren't eligible for this. And that could have killed even the ability to sell to them under this program, and they were willing to work around that. So they were good, and I just wanted to put that in perspective. So two of your three options are feed-in tariffs, one with Marin Clean Energy, the other with PG&E. They both have big, fat documents, lots of legal terms, and it's pretty much a take-it-or-leave-it situation. The bill credit is a completely different program. It's not I generate, you buy, I sell, simple buy-sell. It really is a program designed for a customer who could generate more electricity on their site than they can use on that site to share that with themselves. They can't sell it to anybody else. You couldn't sell it to the prison or to the garbage company down the street, but you could sell it to yourselves. And originally, when we first started this, the law did not allow JPAs to include member agencies in that. If CMSA had a pump station off campus or something else, you could have included that. You could not get it to member agencies, and that changed, and there was legislation that changed that. So if you read our first report, it said you can't do RESBCT, the bill credit program, to your member agencies, and then later on report said, great, new law. And what it does is really allow you now to produce more renewable energy here at the plant and get it to any of your member agencies, any accounts that they want to sign up for. So that's kind of the overview. Let's get into some of the details. So Marin Clean Energy's feed-in tariff, there's two basic requirements to be eligible for. Three. It has to be renewable energy. It can't be nuclear or natural gas or anything like that. It can't be larger than 1 megawatt in size, though Marin Clean Energy just announced a new program for bigger projects, up to 5 megawatts. And it has to be located in MCE territory. So three check marks. You met all of those. Their PPA term, appropriately the thing to say is it's a 20-year term. For you, when we expressed that there was some concern brought up by some of the board members early on about a shorter term, they said for CMSA they would consider a 15 or 10-year term, and that, as Jason rightly said, is one of the decisions to make if you decide to go this way. And they offer 10.5 cents at the time. You're in Tier 2. It started out at 12.5, 13?
11.6.
11.6. We missed tier one. We got in on tier two. And from then on, it's been declining about a half a cent. They're now in stage seven, which is 9 cents. And that would have been the end of the program. They would have got their entire 15 megawatts. They just added another 10 megawatts to their program. However, the price keeps going down and ends up at step 12 at 6.5. So you locked in at 10.5 cents, which is why they're putting a deadline on you. Sign this PPA or get out of the way, because other people would like to move up and get that space that you've held, where now you're getting, like 10-15% above that. PG&E's renewable market adjusting tariff, they by the nature of the program would allow 10, 15, or 20. That's an option that you can choose. The current rate is about the same as when they started in 2013, about just a little under 9 cents per kilowatt hour. And then the bill credit program allows excess power generating to generate a financial credit that can be transferred to other eligible accounts. And as of now, that could be any account of any of your member agencies. And that credit is equal to just a little bit under 8 cents. So you got kind of a 10 cent, 9 cent, and an 8 cent option on a price thing. The one thing I want to mention about the prices, though, is that the first two are fixed price. 10.5 or 8.9 cents today, same price 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. No escalation, no de-escalation. It's fixed. The bill credit transfer is actually varies with the PG&E rate that would be charged here at the plant. It's called the E19 rate. And so when we say today it's 7.7 cents, tomorrow it could go up, next year it could go up. So it's a little bit different animal. As Jason said, we were tasked to really look at all of the programs, and we presented and prepared, and I believe it's in your agenda package, a much more detailed analysis of all the different contract terms and pros and cons. I wanted to highlight a couple of them, though, that I thought were really important. So from the MCE feed-in tariff program, it's the highest tariff rate today. And obviously getting more money is better than getting less money. The second one, I think, is even more important, that unlike the PG&E remat, the PG&E power purchase system, there are no penalties for non-delivery or inaccurate forecasting. You don't have to send them anything. If you don't send them any power, you don't get any payment from it, but there's no penalties, and I'll contrast that with PG&E in a minute. It's also the least administrative burden. Basically, once you get flowing with PG&E, get the interconnection done, automatically the power you need here at the plant will be kept here at the plant. Anything else jumps the fence. They multiply it by 10.5 cents and write you a check. Very little burden for staff. The cons, there are no termination provisions for a seller. Once you sign it, you're in. You can't say, oh, just kidding. And the reason they do that is they're paying you more. They're paying you a high price, 10.5 cents, which each year, assuming power keeps going up, gets less and less onerous on them. What they don't want to do is have people jump in for 2 or 3 years, get this fat 10.5 cents, and then say, oh, we're out of here. And when it starts being advantageous to them, they're not around. The other potential con is that you at the plant would be required to have MCE as your power company, which you do now. So you would not be allowed to change. The way this is set up, though, essentially all of your power will be produced by your own cogen system, other than when it's down for maintenance. And so your purchasing from MCE should be very small. Second, then comparing that with the REMAT, one advantage of REMAT is you could stay an MCE customer and still sell the power to PG&E. So there's no requirement to go to PG&E as your service provider if you sold them the power. And there are some limited termination rights, although they come with a really big price tag. You essentially, to terminate, you could do it, you would have to pay them for all of the power that you didn't send them. And it's, there are rights, but they're so expensive, I don't know that anyone has ever actually used them. Con side, they're a little bit lower in price. They are the highest administrative burden, so they require you to forecast for 20 years, assuming you want a 20-year or 10-year, if you want a 10-year term, forecast each year how much electricity you would send them. Then you have to update that monthly, and ultimately when you start, you have to update that daily. So every day, somebody on the CMSA staff would have to figure out how much the cogen plant is going to produce today because of the deliveries of fats, oils, and grease and food waste. They'd have to subtract out how much we're going to need here at the plant and say, okay, here's the difference, and report that for the next day. And that would be every single day, 24/7, 365 days a year. Lots of reporting, lots of scheduling. So it's not a full-time job, but it's definitely a big level of effort for staff. And then the last point, and I think is very significant, is the damages for under-delivery. In most renewable energy projects, it's not that difficult to forecast the delivery. There's good statistics on sunshine, on wind flow, and you can pretty well predict that. Yours is really complicated because it depends on who brought food, waste, and gas the day before, whether it's a Saturday or a Sunday, and things are a little different. How much the plant is going to need that day. If you get a rainstorm and your pumps are going like crazy just to get the storm water through, and you're going to pay, and you could pay, according to that formula, up to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. You would pay them for electricity that you didn't provide them. So I think that's one of the biggest cons that, you know, if I were in your shoes and having to make this decision, I would be concerned about. The RESPEC, no scheduling responsibilities. It just all flows automatically. There's no long-term commitment. You could decide to do the PG&E RESPEC program today, and a year later you could say, we don't like it anymore, and cancel it. And the rates may escalate over time. They're not fixed rates, so perhaps you could get paid more over time. The cons, and I think the first one is really significant. CMSA would have to stop using MCE as its power provider. In addition, any member agency who wanted to be a beneficiary of this bill credit, at least for that account, would also have to opt out of MCE and be a PG&E customer. So let's say San Rafael wants to apply the bill credits to its big pump station. That pump station, as well as all of MCE's operations here, all of CMSA's operations here, would have to become PG&E customers. I mentioned on the pro side, the rates may escalate. They may also decline, and there have been periods of time when prices have actually gone down. And there's no certainty in the program longevity. Unlike a contract that you might have with PG&E or MCE on the other two, it's a program that's allowed and required by the California Public Utilities Commission. They could change their mind. They could say, no, we're not going to continue that program on, and it would be over. And we did a project, Ryan and I, for Marin County, where there was a major investment that needed to be made. It was a landfill gas project, not a wastewater. And the fact that the PG&E could stop the program, or the Public Utilities Commission could stop it, killed that program. The bankers weren't willing to say, yes, we'll loan you all this money, several million dollars, to build this project, because there was no certainty that the program would be gone. There is some administrative complexity and effort. I put it in between the MCE being the easiest and PG&E FIT program being the hardest. The most interesting and probably challenging part is in the setup, because the allocation of these bill credits amongst the member agencies and choosing who gets how much and which accounts are in and out, That has to happen initially. Then there has to be a review every year of that allocation and a reconsideration. There'd have to be... I just say that that's kind of an interesting complexity that would have to be dealt with up front and then annually.
Or burrito days in the parks department there.
This is a fairly, supposed to be a simple chart, and it just shows that the MCE FIT program, about 10.5 cents flat all the way through the 20 years. PG&E below it is the green line. That's also flat at just under 9 cents. And then we modeled the RESPEC because we don't know what the future pricing or the bill credit is going to be worth. The middle of the three curved lines is historically what's happened here at CMSA over the last 10 years, 2% annual increase, kind of smoothed out over time. And so you can see on that that it doesn't catch up with the MCE top line. I guess I could point. Where's the... Oops, wrong one, sorry. No. Jason, where's the pointer on here?
It's this top button right here.
For 8 years.
Yeah, thank you.
there,
okay. Good. Yeah, so it would catch up with, it would be 8 years to catch up to PG&E and almost 17 years to catch up to the MCE rate. And it's really only this one where it starts looking pretty interesting. Around year 4 or 5, it catches up to PG&E. Around year 8, catches up with MCE. And you can see this better in this slide, in this table, where we did the net present value. We used a 5% discount rate, and we said, okay, over a 10, 15, or 20-year period, at two different levels of power output, which is the best, just purely from a financial standpoint? And you can see that the dark ones, MCE's FIT wins almost every time. The only time it didn't is the smaller output under the 20-year scenario, and the RESPEC with the highest rate of inflation that we put in just barely beat it out. So pretty much from a financial standpoint, unless there's really high inflation of the power rates over time, the MCE FIT wins as the most economically attractive. From the standpoint of the program terms, the current power prices, this compares MCE to the other two. MCE is higher than PG&E, REMAT, or that you could get under RESPEC. In terms of long term, it's always going to be better than PG&E REMAT because they're always fixed prices. Unknown, really, in RESPEC. It depends what happens in the future with inflation. It would have to be a pretty high escalation rate for it to become better. And that's what the little asterisk is. Tariff scheduling and administrative obligations. MCE is the easiest. RESPEC is the next most difficult. And the PG&E REMAT is pretty significant scheduling and administrative staff level of effort. Penalties for renewable power under delivery, MCE has none, can't get better than that. The REMAT has significant ones, why we gave it a minus, and RESPEC doesn't have it anything at all because you would simply not generate a bill credit, therefore San Rafael, as I used in my example, wouldn't see a deduction that month, but there's no penalty. And the termination rights with PG&E and REMAT are, the best from termination standpoint is the bill credit program because you could stop it any time you wanted to. The REMAT has, like I said, some limited ability to terminate at a very high price.
I have a question.
Sure.
Is it really an apples-to-apples comparison, or are the maintenance of the grid built into MCE's pricing? Or is that always a separate add-on?
It's always a separate add-on.
So PG&E doesn't have that luxury, correct?
It's factored in the same way for both of them. So when you pay your bill, or when MCE receives it, they have to pay PG&E for delivering it from your meter to wherever it goes. So PG&E gets paid the same amount whether you pay it or they pay it.
But the rules are different, I would observe, in no small way linked to the maintenance of the grid issue because of the protections that PG&E, the rules that they impose on those wanting to sell power on their grid, not them. Mm-hmm. So it would seem to me that it's MCE is always going to come out on top when they're not taking care of the grid.
No, because MCE has to pay PG&E at the approved rates for the transmission and distribution.
I'm not making myself clear.
Help me, Ryan, with this if you can. So try again.
I don't know that I can. I just would observe that because the rules are different between the agreements, that value is reflected not through pricing, but just through the way the agreements are structured.
May I pose a question?
Sure.
That I think might get to kind of what this is about.
It doesn't change our decision.
Mm-hmm. Right. What MCE might be paying us if we go with MCE would include not just the power itself, but whatever it took for it to be directed on the grid. Mm-hmm. PG&E, if we decide to go with PG&E, whatever they paid us also would be not just for the electrons, you know, the power itself, but also for the distribution on the grid.
Right.
So both prices include both those factors, correct?
That's correct. At the exact same price on the other side of the grid. So if PG&E has to report to the Public Utilities Commission what they call their transmission and distribution costs, all taking care of all the grid stuff. And if MCE wants to use that service to move your green electron to Whole Foods in San Rafael or wherever it is, they have to pay that amount to PG&E. Otherwise, it's an internal PG&E cost. But the contracts are the same in that your only obligation is to deliver it to your meter here on that site, and then somebody picks it up there. MCE picks it up, and they move it around and on PG&E's line, and they pay PG&E that, or PG&E moves it around to the ultimate customer, and that's an embedded cost. So either way, your obligation is the same under each, and the numbers are equivalent. That helped, Dan? I'm not sure you articulated it very well.
It doesn't change our thinking on the issue.
Okay. All right. Last slide, except I have one more if we need it. So what happens then? You've got three choices if you want to continue on with this program. First is to sign the MCE Power Purchase Agreement. Deadline's the 20th, and the other decision within that is 10, 15, or 20 years. And then it's just finishing up the interconnection upgrade, and you can begin selling power this summer. So that's very clear cut. The REMAT is a whole new application program. So there's a thing called a PPR, Program Participation Request. It's electronic forms. There's 12 of them, 15 forms that have to be filled out. And a fee has to be paid. So assuming you want to move ahead with PG&E, it's not a slam dunk that a power purchase agreement would be available to you. In the old days, there was a thing called standard offers, and you could actually go down to 77 Beale Street, and you could sign a PPA right there, and if you met the requirements. Not like that. You have to go through this process. And that's why that's where the market adjusting tariff comes from, and it would take longer than you want to hear tonight to explain that whole program. But basically, what would happen is if you directed staff to move towards the PG&E REMAT, they would prepare this lengthy application, file it all electronically, pay a fee, $2 per kilowatt. We said we'll probably get the PPR done in a month, and then pay the fee. It takes that about a month for them to receive it and get your bill out. And then every 2 months, there's an auction. And they auction off, I believe it's 5 megawatts at a time. And so when you get through parts 1 and 2, your application is in and deemed complete and you made your payment, you're assigned a queue number. So you might be group number 15 in line. And so what they do is they take these 5 megawatts every other month, and they go to queue member number one, and they say, do you want it? And they can grab up to 3 megawatts of it. And let's say they say no. Then there's 5 megawatts for queue number two, and the biggest project grab can be 3 megawatts. So number two then says, yeah, I want 1.5 megawatts of it. Now there's 3.5 of it. And they keep working down the queue until people either say, no, I don't want to accept it, or because I'm not ready, or I think the price may go up, or it's gone. Then if you're below that queue, then you move up as these others drop off, and maybe you'll get it 2 months later, and you may wait a while. So that's the process, and nobody knows that. It's all secret who's in the queue, how many people are in the queue. They don't publish any of that. So I just want you to understand, it's not like, you know, if you say PG&E, that we'll go down tomorrow and get you a PPA. It's going to be a multi-month process with you know, a little more effort. And the price can change at each one of these two bi-monthly auctions. It hasn't changed much since it started in 2013. So, and they've used up about half of their allocation. So it's likely you could get this. I just didn't want you to. I just wanted you to understand that there is a process. RESBEC is pretty straightforward. You can roll. There's some paperwork to fill out. Figuring out the interesting question of how to allocate the energy credits amongst the member agencies, and how does that affect the economics for CMSA, who's bearing all the costs. You then opt out of MCE, and as soon as the interconnection is done this summer, it'd be business as usual, and your member agencies would see little deductions on their bills in according to the proration. So that's the choice. I mean, there are three. You know, you got it. I think you have a Fuji apple, a Granny Pippin apple, and a pineapple to choose from. There are two things that are kind of resemble each other, and one very different. And at this point, I'd be happy to answer any questions, help any way I can.
What's your next slide?
Oh, the next slide is this is a bill to show where the 7.7 cents is, because people go, I'm spending 20 cents a kilowatt hour. I'd rather it go to my pump station. And why is it only 7.7 cents? I'll do this real quick because we're here. So first of all these other charges, this is the E19 from San Rafael, and you would, by going with the RESBEC, you would have to go back to PG&E, and so this is what your bill would be structured like. So anything that's not highlighted in pink or whatever that color is, you don't get any credit for that. That's going to still be paid by San Rafael or whoever the member agency is. Then you see these energy charges, which fool a lot of people, because they say, well, wait a minute, it's peak, partial peak, and off-peak different times of the day and the season, and I see 15, 11, and 8. How did you get 7.7? And the reason is it's only the generation portion of those energy charges, and there's about 2.2 cents of what they call non-bypassable charges that is built into that you don't get a credit for. So when you net out all that, you end up, in this particular bill, they would end up saving 7.7 cents for each kilowatt hour that they use. So that was the last one.
Do you have a recommendation?
Oh, I was really hoping you wouldn't ask me. And actually,
okay, here's my question. Why would we not pick for least brain damage with MCE?
That's what I would do absent. Well, let's see. Let me break it down a little bit more. And sorry if I can't
to
just
me,
say.
This is really easy.
Yeah,
why would we not do that?
I would do it. That's what I would do. Between PG&E's tariff, or PG&E's FIT program, and MCE's, I think MCE beats them in every way. Doesn't have the damages, which you're going to pay. There's no way any human can predict your daily output with any accuracy. It's, you know, more money. So to me, between the two FIT programs, MCE pays you more and has a lot less risk.
Well, I'm just going to say I think it's the least shitty deal.
I would agree
okay.
with that.
Okay. Thank you for that assessment. Mary Beth.
Mr. Brown, I have quite a few questions for you. Okay. I actually don't quite really know where to begin. I guess maybe with the biggest concept. Do you know what resource adequacy means?
Vaguely, yeah.
Okay.
He probably knows a lot more than I do. This is Ryan, my chief of staff.
Hi, Ryan. Do you know what resource adequacy means?
I do, yes.
Okay. What do you think the resource adequacy value of this contract is to MCE?
To MCE.
To MCE. Not knowing what their other power procurement looks like, I would say it has... I don't want to put a number specifically to that value. I know there are...
It seems like MCE agrees with you on that, because if you turn to Exhibit D, I believe it is, of this contract, where we're supposed to be defining the resource, mm-hmm. it's blank. These numbers are blank. This page is blank.
Yeah, we have to complete that internally as part of...
And what are you going to put in there? That's a really, really important question, because that defines the output. Whatever number you put in there is what we commit. If you look in the section mm-hmm. scheduling, if you look in scheduling, let me give you a reference for that. And the reason I'm talking about resource adequacy is because that's exactly what they're talking about. Schedule section 11, scheduling obligations. Resource adequacy is a concept that the CAISO uses. It is it's the reason for PG&E's having all of those requirements. Tell us what your schedule is. You pay a penalty if you don't meet the schedule, because they have to turn the schedule into the CAISO to meet their load. The resource adequacy is a concept of how are we going to meet our load, mm-hmm. and you turn in a resource and say what it is. That's why PG&E has so many penalties. Mm-hmm. MCE has no penalties. Why is that? Because they're not using us for resource adequacy? Why would they do that? That's the only way they get value out of a resource. Doesn't make sense. Go to Section 11, scheduling. At MCE's direction, MCE's designated scheduling coordinator, which is usually some big outfit that has a contract with the CAISO, shall employ good, the seller shall employ good utility practice and instruction to operating all necessary generation, seller at its own expense responsible for complying with all contractual metering and interconnection requirements. That means that MCE has a right through its scheduling coordinator, as defined in the CAISO tariff, to call on CMSA to produce.
Except there's no penalty for not doing it. Where in the PG&E contract, if you put them side by side, there's a whole formula. It refers to Exhibit G, I believe, which is this complicated formula that says you didn't deliver,
right.
PG&E got penalized, and you owe me that much up to 75% of the contracted value. So I agree with you completely that...
Well, wait a minute. No, we have a contractual obligation to deliver.
With no penalty for failure to deliver.
I don't know where you went to law school, but when you have a contractual obligation to deliver, if you say, I'm going to bring you 10 pairs of glasses tomorrow, and I don't have to say, and the penalty will be if you don't bring 10, I'm going to there will be a penalty. You have a contractual obligation to deliver those 10. I can sue you for not delivering those 10. That's the difference. Just because there's not a price for non-delivery.
Let's continue.
We've already continued. This contract obligates us to deliver whatever we say is the output of the plant as defined in Appendix D. And Appendix D is freaking blank.
It's always been blank since October.
We haven't finished
this because
we've
been getting through
all at the rate. That's the deal.
That's not what it says here.
If I can interject, I totally agree with Mr. Bushy. And that's the biggest problem we had in the Energy Committee was the inadequacy of the contract itself. I think it's a no-brainer, as Dan pointed out, to go with MCE based on price and all the other pros. But the real big con that the Energy Committee saw was the ability to tailor this for this. They'll put in it's a 1 megawatt system, but and they'll have this as their resource adequacy. But and they will advertise they got 1 megawatt of biogas generation, but they're getting 95% of the time they're going to get maybe 5 kilowatts. And we have no ability to sort of tailor it and just put those words in to say it's going to be variable from 0 to 1 megawatt. We can't tailor. And so we were pulling our hair out with Jason and his staff to try to get this to be more specific for this very unique type
aren't
of
situation.
Aren't
you working against your own interests with that argument?
No.
Our interest is in what's in the long-term best interest.
They're going to tighten the deal if you want to.
Well, they don't need to tighten. They flow through all the CAISO penalties. So when they don't meet their resource adequacy needs in section 11.2.2, the CAISO penalizes them for not meeting their resource adequacy obligation, and those penalties flow through to us pursuant to the terms of the contract.
Are you referring to the resource adequacy rulings, meaning CPU decisions 410-1050, 410-035, 510-042? 06, 06.
I have all those decision numbers committed to memory.
I don't know if you looked at these. I don't know. You know
what page
I'm asking. This is on page. I just have another page. Right. It's on the contract, the Appendix A, last page of Appendix A, where it talks about resource adequacy benefits, and then it talks about the resource adequacy rulings.
Okay, that could be.
So I think maybe we should look at those rulings.
I have had some experience with them.
Okay.
And it's a basic concept of every utility has an obligation, and Ryan and Ms. Ryan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, has an obligation to procure resources adequate to meet their projected load. And they have to turn in a list to the CAISO and say, here's my list of resources. Presumably, this will end up on the MCE's list of resources.
Mm-hmm.
At the number, and if you look at the contract, says contract capacity of the facility is equal to the nameplate rating of the facility, which is a megawatt, right?
750 kilowatts.
750 kilowatts.
I'm not prepared to have the board do what the staff should be doing.
Well,
meeting, I just don't think that's.
We have been over this
think.
Several times, and.
Are you saying you disagree with the staff?
Yes.
Well, then, continue the item.
Yes, I don't think, but we've been over this.
Doesn't matter. I'm not going to.
Let's make a decision. The real decision, in my mind, is
it's not locking. Incredible conversation.
Hold on, Dan. Let's
locking ourselves into a number for 10 years. And we're locking ourselves into a provider and a contractual number, and with contractual terms that create unknown risk. There's a lot of risk with this contract because it's unknown and it's ill-fitting for the type of resource that we are.
I think you and I agree.
Michael's been kicked off. Can we get him back on?
Michael?
But I don't think arguing about it.
I don't want to argue about it, and I don't want anyone to feel that I'm, you know, in any way impugning their analysis. It's just, you know, we have in front of us a contract that doesn't fit, that creates risk. The marginal gain that we'll get out of it is at best like 30%. It's a 30% difference in price, but we're locked in. We've got risk.
There you are.
Okay.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, I'm back.
Okay. Welcome back, Michael.
Mary Beth, can I ask you a couple of things?
Please.
First of all, I remember hearing that there was a question about that, the label related to the product or capacity, and it had to do with what was on the label. Where is that in this agreement? Do you recall? Is that one of the definitions? Is the generation?
The nameplate. No, you mean the nameplate.
That's
yes,
it.
That's what you mean. You mean the nameplate. That's in section
2.2. 2.2.
Right. And the contract capacity is the nameplate rating.
Got it.
Yeah, that's what now, it says on the generator.
Look at 2.3 also, that is where they have made some concessions, and you're saying we're not going to sell you the full contract capacity and buy everything back from NC. It shows that we have selected the excess sale arrangement as described in 2.3.1. So this contract, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm not saying it legally definitive, but as I read it from a business standpoint, it says it's coming out of in your case, 750 kilowatt generator, and it's saying we will sell you whatever we don't need. So if you need it, or the generator is down for maintenance, you have no obligation to sell them anything. They have no obligation to pay you for something that you don't sell them. And that's how they've explained the limitation to your liability or your risk.
That's what they've told us a few times, even in writing, because we've asked some of these questions related to the concerns of the committee about, you know, responsibility to deliver so much, liability to the agency if we don't. And they keep coming back to this section 2.3.1. All you're obligated to do is sell us power in excess of what you use on site.
Well, we specifically covered this at our last meeting.
Okay, so my next question is with Appendix D, coupled with Section 2.3, could we adequately protect the agency from the concerns that Mary Beth has raised? And I think they're very good concerns.
I want to interject quickly that the interconnection that CMSA is pursuing with PG&E is an energy-only interconnection. So there is an option for the interconnection to be energy only or fully deliverable status. And the fully deliverable status allows credits for resource adequacy. Mm-hmm. But since we've decided to do an energy only interconnection, we are not eligible for resource adequacy credits. And we're actually in the process presently of being able to opt back into fully deliverable status. But that doesn't benefit CMSA in any way because neither REMAT nor the MCE FIT provides additional revenue stream for that resource adequacy credit. So I think I'm hoping that kind of explains why there's nothing in this contract about that, because we are locked into an energy-only interconnection and energy-only contract with MCE or REMAT for that matter.
So therefore, they cannot take credit for resource adequacy as one of the values from this, because we're not promising them that we'll ever have more than we need on site. If you look at Appendix D, a bunch of its address and stuff, but the important ones are 5, 6, and 7. Mm-hmm. So 5 is the contract capacity, which is the nameplate of your generator. By checking box 2.3, you've said, yeah, we could produce 750, but we're only going to give you what we don't need. And I can't imagine a time when you don't need some energy here. So you right away have explained to them that while we have a 750 kilowatt generator, you're not going to see that much because you get net of what we want.
Well, that's a nice. So are you saying it's like number 7, the expected annual energy output of the facility is 0?
No, you could. You
it is.
6 says what is the maximum hourly delivery, and we could say we could put whatever number in there. And they're saying contract capacity times 1 hour. So they want you to say we could give you, not will, could give you as a maximum 750 kilowatts in 1 hour. Okay, so that's in 6. Now 7. Is the expected annual energy output, and that would be what we expect. But there's nowhere in here that I see that says, which is in the PG&E contract, if you don't give us what you say you expect to give us, you pay. It just says you send it over the meter. If it's there, we buy it. So I think you are adequately protected. And again, I'm not an attorney, so
but
I can't argue.
But Appendix D, we can't say that our expected annual energy delivery is 750 times.
No, you wouldn't.
What number would we say?
Well, the two cases we showed you were between 100 and 150.
We'll probably pick something, you know, closer to 100.
Yeah. So we worked with staff, and they analyzed the needs of the plant and went through, right, you know, monthly bills, and somewhere in the 100 to 150 is what we all felt comfortable would be available on the average for them. So, yeah, we're only talking about that very small range, and that's why I put on the table up there.
Let's
go back.
That can't be 100 kilowatt hours.
100 kilowatts. So you see 100 kilowatts. So your generator is 750 kilowatts. So it would generate 750 kilowatts times 8,760 hours. That's how much that thing could do if it never went down, never needed maintenance, and just ran flat out. So that's the maximum. So then you back off for a certain amount, around 10%, for times when it isn't running. It is not fully... it needs maintenance. You back off times when the fuel may not be there because you're only allowed 2% natural gas. You have to run it essentially 98% at least on biogas. And then you again back out everything the plant needs. And we're coming up with, working closely with staff, between 100 and 150 of that 750. So your expected is... it's only a very small part of that 750. And again, it's on an as-available basis, so neither MCE nor PG&E can claim it for as a guaranteed source for resource adequacy. They don't know if they're going to get anything.
Can I read a little bit of CPUC decision 060703-1? Penalties for non-performance. The workshops revealed concern that the willingness and ability of buyers and sellers to negotiate contracts for raw capacity, is RAR, or is undetermined because penalties for non-performance by generators and by LSEs subject to our raw program have not been defined with sufficient clarity. For example, parties find it unclear when an LSE has demonstrated compliance with the raw requirements and when its obligation ends with respect to the seller's performance. Such uncertainty affects the determination of performance exposures between the parties and how contracting parties might mitigate that risk. Parties therefore ask that any potential penalties for non-performance be clearly defined in order to facilitate the most economic transaction. And it is clearly defined, but there's no penalty for non-sale, non-performance.
You can keep saying that, but I'm sorry, I don't see it. I don't think that's what the contract says or what it could be interpreted to say.
Okay.
And that's a problem. As soon as they turn this in, and maybe we can cleverly fill out Appendix D so that they don't have any resource adequacy benefits from this, and then they're in a corner. But then they're going to come back to us because. It doesn't make any sense that their terms would be so different from PG&E's. They're selling into the same market. They have the same resource adequacy obligations. Why would MC not have any penalties? That doesn't make any sense.
Wait a minute. Are you certain that MCE does have the same resource adequacy requirements? Because it would seem to me that PG&E would, because they're the main power provider, but MCE would not.
No, that's not. No, they everybody has the same,
right.
But they have to meet their load. They have to meet their load. I don't know what our options are here.
I can come up with that option.
What?
We could approve the contract with MCE pending a written agreement regarding resource adequacy provisions and ensure that this 060703-1 penalties for non-performance is the answer to that, which is there is no penalty for non-performance according to CPUC decision 060703-1 3.3, penalties for non-performance.
I think that's a great idea, and we have pressed MCE on supplementary conditions to the contract. They are non-receptive. Jason,
I heard that.
We beat him up till he was blue to try to get supplementary conditions.
But if Jason said to them, we have tentatively agreed to this by the board, pending this provision, which we feel is a concern, and that you may feel is not a concern because you never enforce it. And again, I think if I'm reading this CPUC decision, they can't enforce it. If it's indicated that there's no penalty in the contract, because that's what this says, because of concerns that they would have to put in the contract, or they should put in the contract, what the penalties for non-performance are, and the contract says that penalties for non-performance are zero.
Except if the CAISO.
Except what?
Except if the CAISO penalties flow through, when you don't meet your resource adequacy. Here's an idea.
There's no doubt, but
here's another path to get to where you want to go, I think. There's no doubt that Appendix D is part of this proposed contract. There's equally no doubt it's not filled out. Mm-hmm. And why don't we table this matter pending a filling out of this form? And we fill it in, and we instruct our staff to fill this out, showing, being consistent with no obligation to deliver. So the expected annual energy output of the facility would be a range, 0 to whatever you...
150.
Whatever, 150 times 8,000.
You're talking about item 7, right? So we have the range in item 7?
Right. The range in item 7 would be 0 to 150 times 8,000.
It's just going
to
be 0 for quite a while. Because we have to have the... Say this is approved tonight, and we put the 0 in there, or range, you're fine with that. Who knows really when PG is going to finish their work, because they're already behind schedule. Who knows when they're going to finish reviewing our design. Then we have to go out and identify more organics to bring in. And that's been on hold until we get all these pieces put in place. Okay. So it could be a while before we even start have the ability to become energy self-sufficient and start delivering power, you know, periodically.
I know, and it's unpredictable and all of that uncertainty. Why on earth are we signing a decade-long contract for something we don't even know that we're going to be able to produce? And if so, when we'll be able to produce that? And whether we'll be able to continue doing it?
Yeah, the only reason it's here tonight is because of the deadline for the price. That's the only reason.
Something they're driven. They told us to pound sand when we wanted an extra year to think about this.
That's right.
You know, why are we doing this? You know, we don't... There's too many uncertainties.
But can we use the uncertainties to our favor by locking in at that price?
Well, that's called risk.
And then
working at some cryptocurrencies.
And then going with exactly what you want during the 12 months, and get those assurances. Because I think I'm interpreting it the way the deal, the way he is that it's just whatever extra we get.
Well, if that's true, then we put zero.
At that great rate for a decade.
We put a range.
What MC said. When we asked for the 12-month extension, besides saying you have to have the agreement in place before we'll extend, they said if you do that, then you could extend. Then you have 24 months to start delivering power. So that gave us, you know, a nice 2-year window to be energy self-sufficient, bring other materials in. But that may not happen. We're going to try real hard, but
we may never. The truth is that CMSA may never deliver any surplus for sale to MCE.
That could be true.
But all we have to do in the next year is get the system completed, up and running, and certified. And then whether we have excess power to sell or not, that could go on for 10 years at a zero.
It could.
If we fill this out right.
Yeah. But there is in the termination events, it says, you know, they could terminate within, after 12 months if you're not delivering any power.
Well, that might happen to us.
Yeah, so we'd have 24 months then if we had the 12-month extension. So we'd have 24 months before we hit that termination event trigger.
Yeah, and according to Mike, our schedule is to be pretty much done with PG&E's work by the end of the year, let's say?
Hopefully sooner than that. We're hoping by the summertime, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I heard summer, but...
My experience with PG&E might be fall. Once it gets through the... into the engineering and construction department, it moves pretty regularly.
And it's there now, just going to construction.
Yeah. I had a question. Considering this whole resource adequacy issue in the CAISO, Is there any exception that anybody is aware of for the smaller producers under a feed-in tariff program as opposed to kind of a major producer who's contracting with, say, an MCE? Because your explanation of the feed-in tariff was that it's for smaller producers. They try to streamline, make things easier. It would seem that resource adequacy would be one of those things that might not apply to those small, incidental little producers.
Mike, wasn't it that, you know, the CAISO scheduling was only for 1 megawatt and greater facilities?
Right. So you're exempt from the scheduling issues. Ryan pointed out, and I'll say it again, you're not even promising resource adequacy credit to anybody because of the way that your interconnection with PG&E was filed. It says it's on a as available, as delivered, no commitment we're going to ever give you anything basis. So there's, I don't see how PG&E could claim or MCE could claim that you didn't deliver your resource adequacy when it's not a resource adequacy generating interconnection.
Okay. This is just, I'm sorry, the words do not on the page are not consistent with what you've said.
Okay.
If you look at page, this is just a numbered section, 10.2, an event of termination is seller fails to deliver energy from the facility consistent with the selected energy delivery profiles calculated over the most recent rolling 24-month period. Okay, energy profile, so we go look that up. What does that mean?
What section is that, 10.2?
10.2, and then we have to look up energy portfolio, which is defined in the front section in 2.1.1. And they've typed in here, the facility's energy delivery profile is baseload.
Definition of baseload for MCE, though, is anything that doesn't fit as available or peaking. So, as a default, essentially, we fall under baseload.
So, okay. So, what does that mean?
So, it basically means it's not intermittent. That's all it means.
So it's consistent.
But it's not requiring MCE, or it's not requiring CMSA to deliver resource adequacy.
No, in this section it's about it has to deliver energy. It's an event of termination. If you don't deliver energy from the facility consistent with base load over the most recent 24-month period.
There's no implication that resource adequacy is being required from this project. And when we selected the interconnection, we selected energy only. And PG&E and MCE are well aware of that. And so I guess my contention is because we are not a fully deliverable status project, which under fully deliverable status, you have requirements for resource adequacy, that we are an energy-only interconnection project, that we are not held to the same requirements as a fully deliverable status project.
And how are we not fully deliverable status?
Point of order, Madam Chair, can we move through the action items on the agenda and put this at the end? You're going to lose me in about 15 minutes because this is so open-ended. I don't even know what issues you're wanting to frame.
If anybody would like to second that, I'd hear it, but I'm not willing to make that change unilaterally. Anybody?
I'd rather finish this.
What is it we're doing?
We're trying to get through this.
But I don't understand what issue we're talking about would lead us to a decision.
Well, Mary Beth was speaking. Would you like to finish your point, Mary Beth, and then we'll... perhaps as a board try to figure out how we can move forward for her.
But if I summarize, I think we are concerned with we wanted to bring this to the full board because we could not make any further headway. We did the best we could at the energy community level, and we see significant risk. And Mary Beth is doing a darn good job of pointing out the risk, the contractual risk that approval of this would we put our repairs and our member agencies into with any undue litigation, should we not be able to look at power.
Thank you. And what you're referring to is the ad hoc committee on energy.
That's correct.
So, hold on, folks. One at a time, please. Did the committee make a recommendation above and beyond simply voicing a concern about this particular contract?
We couldn't make a recommendation to move forward for approval.
Okay.
We weren't confident that there was not that it was rock solid and risk free, that we wanted to disclose that to the board and present it in this way.
Okay. Did that discussion take into consideration what the alternatives were?
Yes.
But you did not come to a recommendation of looking at an alternative to this contract at this time?
No, we did not.
Dan?
So I didn't see any of that in the staff report. So the recommendation of the committee is to not move on any of the three options.
Sounds like they don't have a recommendation.
We didn't. Yeah, that's true.
So why are we having this on the agenda?
Because they didn't have a recommendation doesn't mean we don't.
Yeah, we're discussing it. Yeah. Did you have something else to add, Doug?
Yeah, I would stick with my suggestion. I think that the price is in the best interest of the ratepayers, and if we can lock it in now, it would make sense. We could pass this tentatively based only on the satisfaction that the general manager of the Central Marin Sanitation District has clarified with MCE that we cannot and will not be penalized and cannot and will not be part or held responsible for any resource adequacy shortcomings of MCE based on our non-deliverable. We could fill out Appendix D, and we could make that clear. I think Mary Beth has brought up some great concerns, and she's an attorney, I'm not. But if those concerns are not valid, then, you know, and I understand from Jason's staff report that MCE has been hesitant to do anything, but, you know, if we present them with a opportunity that we've signed this or we are signing off on this, pending their simple clarification of this concern, and they don't meet the you know, they don't resolve the concern for us, well, then I would support Mary Beth's concern and your concern that we don't move forward on this. But if they do, and therefore the concern's been evaporated, why miss the deadline for the better price that's in the best interest of our ratepayers?
Then may I ask a question? Could that communication from MCE to CMSA regarding the resource allocation issue, could that be in the form of a letter? Because we already know that they are extremely reluctant to make any changes to this contract.
Yeah, like a letter would be sufficient.
And if we get that, would you folks who sit on the energy subcommittee feel that that would be adequate to that and Appendix D filled out properly, would that be adequate to protect CMSA on that issue, in your opinion?
I don't believe a letter is enforceable with a contract. The contract is the contract. So embedding it in Appendix D would be the only way I would go, and making it a part of the contract. That's the cleanest, best way to go. Letters get lost, and they've been deemed unenforceable over the contract as well. I'd love to do that. It's the same thing as writing a supplementary condition to a contract, which is basically a signed letter to a contract that is enforceable.
Is there no recommendation from the subcommittee because your risk assessment is such that should we do this? There are consequences you can point out, or you just don't want us to act on this not knowing what might happen later?
I think that's the biggest risk, is not knowing Marine Clean Energy as an entity, and we've never entered into a power sale agreement in the history of our agency.
So you don't think the benefits presented here outweigh the risks?
I haven't decided on that yet. I like some of the options that we have discussed. I think we are mitigating the risk if we can get at least Appendix D filled out properly.
But what about the deadline? Are you willing to let the deadline pass?
No, I would like to get through this matter this evening if we could.
Okay. So what would your recommendation be?
I would say I liked Doug's proposal.
And I could support Doug's proposal if it was just limited to Appendix D. Appendix D is a critical component of this contract, and it's blank. We don't know what we're committing to. Although I'm very sympathetic to Dan, and I think he's absolutely right in his position, we spent enough time on this. I think what we could do is, I hate to use the word accept, but acquiesce to, I guess is the best word, to this garbled agreement. And continue this matter until such time as our staff can bring us back a build-out Appendix D, so that the only issue left is Appendix D, so that we don't get into all of the obvious infirmities of this contract. If Appendix D is properly filled out so that there are zeros in a couple of critical places,
why don't you just say where those zeros are now and put this in? Let us put this in the motion that we approve this pending that being approved.
This expires in 1 week.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So if we want to lock in that price, and if the only holdup really is filling in the blanks on Appendix D,
could we do that tonight?
Okay, so line 5 has a contract capacity.
Well, hold on. I'd also like to reach out and see if Michael has anything to say.
The way I'm looking at it, yes, thank you. This is a very terrific discussion. It's actually very easy to follow on this end. Thank you very much. I think we have two possibilities, PG&E or MCE. I look at the downside, if we just say, okay, if we're going to do PG&E, is that could really hurt us, because there we have to do huge amounts of staff time to monitor and predict, and with big, big penalties if we don't do that there. It seems to me that with MCE, the way I'm reading this is they're going to buy it from us at 10.5 cents, and we're not making them any kind of promise, or that we're just saying we're going to sell to you what we have in excess. That's not defined, and so I think you're right. If in Appendix D, we can, you know, make it vague enough that, you know, we don't know what, you know. I'm leaning towards let's lock in the 10.5%, and I'm just thinking that the risk that we're taking is not that huge as the risk if we were to decide the other alternative and go with PG&E, where I think the risk if we don't perform is huge. And the way I'm reading this, I think it's the same as some other people, is that there's no penalty, or the penalty is unenforceable, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know.
Okay, thank you. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak to this?
Can I be a member of the public for a minute then? Because I was looking really carefully at D and all the definitions. I believe that it's only line 7 of Appendix D that is a concern. Line 5 is the contract capacity, and if you go into section 2.2, which talks about the contract capacity, that just means the nameplate of the machine that's producing it, and then the next one after that, 2.3, says, and you're only going to get a part of it if we don't need it all on site. So I think 5, you would have to say, is whatever the nameplate of your generator is. 6 is the maximum hourly. There's no risk in saying that. And then it's 7 that's the tough one. And that's the expected annual energy output of the facility is blank. And if you put 0 to whatever 150 times 8760 is, I think you're absolutely covered, because no one can go after you for producing zero when it says right there in Appendix 0 it might be zero some years, and it might be up to 150 kilowatts running flat out. I think that would make you very safe.
And the only disagreement I would have is the contract capacity. It's not just, if you want to change that to the nameplate capacity of 750, that would be fine, but they want the contract capacity. So that's the capacity of this facility that is subject to the terms of this contract.
I agree with you, and I put zero in there too.
0 to 750, is that right? And then the other one is in 7 is 0 to...
150 times 8760.
Wait a minute. I want to get my calculator. Is 150 times what?
8,760 hours in a year.
8,750?
Because it's in kilowatt hours.
Okay, it's in the kilowatt. Okay.
Which equals?
Well, contract capacity, let me just read it. The contract capacity, and then parens, of the facility is equal to the nameplate rating of the facility at unity power factor at 60 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, available upon commercial operation of the facility. So,
right, and then the term is defined because it's used in various places throughout the contract, because we don't have we can't search and find out exactly what that means.
Well, that is the definition, because if you go to the definitions page, it refers you to 2.2, where it's defined as the nameplate. So that's where, if you wanted a side letter, which I do think is a good idea from their legal counsel or from their...
Well, wait a minute. Let's look at section 3.3. In accordance with Public Utilities Code section 399, seller conveys to MCE all resource adequacy benefits attributed to the physical generating capacity of seller's facility. To enable MCE to count such capacity towards MCE's resource adequacy requirement. At MCE's request, seller shall take all reasonable actions and execute documents and instructions necessary to enable MCE to secure resource adequacy benefits.
I think the key there is the resource adequacy benefits that are attributable to the generating capacity.
To the physical generating capacity of seller's facility.
Right, and since
that's
we are...
That's everything we've got.
And
that's,
since we are an energy-only facility, as written in our interconnection, the resource adequacy...
Is with PG&E.
Right. So basically, we're not allowed to provide resource adequacy.
Then why are we selling it to them?
We're not selling resource adequacy. We're selling energy-only.
It says right here that we're selling our resource
adequacy. It says we're selling it if it's attributable to the capacity.
To the physical generating capacity of
but
the
facility. Because of our interconnection, it is not attributable to this generator, because we are unable to provide resource adequacy as per our interconnection. So by definition, this generator cannot provide resource adequacy.
So we're in breach of section 3.3?
I'm reading section 3.3, but the way that our interconnection is written is that we do not have resource adequacy credits. So it would be improper for MCE or PG&E to count any generation coming from this generator as resource adequacy, because the interconnection does not allow for that.
So we're in breach?
No.
Well, section 3.3
it's what's attributable. So there is nothing attributable to resource adequacy from this generator. Because of what we selected is not fully deliverable status. So we selected an energy-only status.
In our interconnection agreement with PG&E?
Yes.
So we can't sell them what we're saying here. And do they know that?
No, we can't sell them resource adequacy. But they're not specifically requesting resource adequacy.
Well, only to the physical generating capacity of the seller's facility. Well, our physical generating capacity on a day when we have 120 million gallons of water coming in is zero.
I want 200 a meeting.
What?
Dan, let's stay on topic.
Dan wants to raise
a stipend, huh?
Dan wants
a resolution for that next month.
My contention is there are no resource adequacy benefits attributable to the capacity because of how our interconnection is written.
I concede that that could be very true. However, that's not what the words on the page say. We are contracting to sell something that you believe we can't deliver. That's never a good idea.
Well,
anyway, I think Dan is right. I'm sympathetic to Dan. Unless we're going to increase our pay, we need to deal with this. And I think 0 to 700. If line 5 can say 0 to 750, and line 7 can say 0 to 150 times,
which is 1,312,500.
Excuse me, 500.
1,312,500 is 150 times 8750. It is 8750. You're doing hours.
8,760. 24
times
360.
60 or 50?
60. 8760.
Recount.
Okay.
Okay, so figure out what that is.
Yep.
If you do that, I think there'll be enough votes tonight to approve this agreement.
Just give a direction.
Subject to what?
Yeah, that's about
1,314,000 kilowatt hours. 1,314,000.
And what would the direction? The direction would be to,
if this is approved, to then approve the 10-year or 15 or 20, if we're going there.
10.
I'd say 10.
So it's a 1.3 million under the
zero,
number for number 7.
0 to 1,314,000 kilowatt hours.
Matt, I have a question real quick.
Yes.
You know, in 2.3, as I read it, says the excess sale arrangement. And to me, excess means anything that we're not using, which is our intent to sell them that.
Right. So it might be 0 to 1.3 million kilowatt hours.
Yeah. If we have no excess, according to that, if we had excess, we'd sell it to them. But we don't, so there's no danger.
So
because we don't have excess.
So if we can fill this out like this and get the zeros locked in, if they'll accept that,
I think, you know, we could try to convince them on 7-0 to the 1.3 million just because it's going to be zero if this is approved tomorrow and we sign it. It's going to be zero for a while. I think that one could explain, but the other one I'm having a hard time with is 0-0-750. Because the definition is that Michael read was it's the nameplate, and they might say they may be fine with 0 to 750. So I'm just kind of filling out. If they say what's the nameplate, I say 750, and they say, well, then you have to put 750 in item D, in item 5, excuse me. And if they say that, then the deal. Well, I'm just trying to wonder what's the risk of putting 750 in item 5. I don't see. I'm going to see how it ties to other things. But I see item 7 is very important to have the zero in there. Because that's what will be for quite a while.
I think they'll have trouble with the 0 to 750 because they define the only definition of contract capacity is the nameplate rating of the facility at 60 degrees.
Contract capacity.
It must be used somewhere
else. We can make a special nameplate that's 0 to 750.
Hold on.
For Waukesha.
At the end of after the period of number 5 under Appendix D, could we simply say contract capacity of 750 is the nameplate capacity of the generator? Mm-hmm. And that way we are just simply clarifying that 750 represents the nameplate.
The trouble is contract capacity is defined.
Contract capacity is listed 10 times in the document.
Thank you.
6 times it's listed in paragraph 2.2. The other times it's listed in a definition section of Appendix A stating, referring it back to Section 2.2, and then it's part of the product's definition, also in Section 2.2, and then it's on Appendix D for the ninth appearance, and then ninth and tenth appearance are both on Appendix D for 5 and 6.
Tell me the definition it's used in again.
It is used
2.2.
No, you said in one of the definitions in Appendix A?
Oh, it's used in the definition of products.
Products.
And products is listed in probably like 20 different places.
Okay, well, let's see what this product means. Needs energy, contract capacity, and green attributes. That's our product. No, that is a no-go. No. And green attributes. Energy contract capacity and green attributes. That's our product. And do we sell, how is product used?
But if I look at, well, again,
the seller shall deliver the products from the facility to MCE.
So the green attributes is associated with what we deliver. We still have green attributes associated with what we use on site.
It's not consistent with the words on the page. I understand that that's what they're trying to tell you, but that's not what the words on the page say. Contract capacity, everything up to nameplate is swept into the definition of product. And it's energy capacity and green attributes. So it's everything for the entire plant.
No, well, take a look at 2.3.1. Excess sale. Seller agrees to sell to MCE the facility's gross output of products delivered to the delivery point into the PG&E electrical system for delivery to MCE customers. For purposes of this section, 2.3.1, the energy conveyed to MCE shall be net of station use and any on-site use by seller and transformation and transmission losses.
Right. It's exactly inconsistent with the very next paragraph.
Which paragraph are you referring to?
2.4.1. This thing is a mess. I'm sorry we're taking so much time, but it's just a mess. We can't use 0 to 750 because contract capacity means the product. We have to say 0 to 750. The product that we're delivering, may, as our general manager has told us, for the next 2 years is going to be zero.
You know, we may get really lucky in talking with them because we're not asking to change anything in the agreement. We're just filling out a blank.
Right.
So they may be fine with the 0 to 750.
Are you fine with 0 to 750?
Yeah. Let's be clear. There's no way I'm voting for this. I'm trying to put together something that I think can get enough votes so that Dan can go home. that's all. And I think that will get enough votes.
Shall we... after we put 0 to 750, at the end of that sentence, in parentheses, add the nameplate of the generator, nameplate capacity of the generator is 750.
Well, we're trying
and it's
to,
clear
we're
that that's the nameplate, but we put 0 to 750 in the blank.
Well, we're trying to just fill out the blank because I think Jason's absolutely right. If we stick to their form, then... we're complying with their requests.
Okay.
That's the whole idea, is to stick with the form and not in any words just put 0 to 750 and 0 to 13 million.
1.3.
Or whatever it is. Just do that. And so you could vote, you could approve the agreement subject to Appendix D being negotiated on these terms.
You okay with that, Dean?
I'm fine with moving that forward.
Okay. Okay.
And what Dan, about, I would so move then.
What about Dan, Doug's? I was in
was the refinement?
Agreement with filling this form out to make it say what it needs to say. But also, you had some other language to be inserted. That was what I was agreeing to. But yet, on the flipping back, though, we have a history of knowing that MCE will not allow alteration of this public form. So. Oh.
You know, well, that's why I asked Mary Beth what she wanted. I would still ask Jason, as our general manager, to ask them to clarify, if only in a letter. But having D put in and having the letter, I think we're covered.
We're doing the best on deadline, Brett. You know, it's a good faith effort.
And let me throw one other option out here. I've been in communication with a board member who... is asking about possibly clarifying the definition of product so that it more closely aligns with our interpretation, which is strictly excess electricity. I would like to, for any motion, to allow the general manager to accept any change to the agreement that further clarifies that is the product that we are intending to sell by means of this contract.
That's part of our direction.
and we consider that product to not include resource adequacy on, and only the proportional amounts of green attributes on associated with the delivered.
With excess energy delivered.
With excess energy delivered. What else? I think we're not selling them any capacity, are we?
No.
Now, this is only if we can get, if, you know, the
right,
board
member
can.
We don't think that's going to happen, but.
If we can, that's great. We can get the contract.
If we can do that, and then, but we must get Appendix D with these numbers in them.
I agree.
And on that basis, okay, so make that a motion.
So I got a clarification. So what about this letter we're talking about?
We're asking them for the letter.
We're asking them for a letter?
Yeah.
Well, what if they, is that going to be part of the criteria for us to approve this, is that we need a letter from them? Because I have a feeling they're not going to send us a letter.
We're asking for that over the next 12 months.
I'd say not required, because the filling out of Addendum D will suffice. But I think we're asking a simple question. It's like, look, we don't want to be in your resource allocation requirements, and neither does anybody else. And, you know, they do say on Addendum D, this can be altered. That's the one thing that's the only place I've seen it where they do say it. This can be changed where appropriate. Saying, listen, this is our concern. It's a serious concern for anybody that's selling you power that has a need that is variable, such as ours, where we have high rain days, which require us to use our power, and we're not going to be able to meet your needs. And yet, if you want any other sanitation agencies to join MCE, you're going to have to consider that we're in a business that we cannot be part of your resource allocation requirements. We can't.
It's a reasonable clarification, very close.
And that's the entire concern we have here.
I fully understand that. So in terms of getting approval of the agreement, we have the two revisions to Appendix D. I'm very clear on that. Then we want a letter from them, or can we just have an email exchange from them where they clarify it by email?
I'd rather have a letter.
Well, I understand that. I would too, but I'm saying if we're not going to send you a letter.
I
ask for written clarification. We prefer a letter.
I agree.
In modern business communications, email is a letter. It's written communication.
Yeah.
Sure. I think an email is an official email through all the official channels is these days, it's, you know, you can do a contract with an e-signature. That's
what we need, and then ask for what we want.
I would so move that we give that direction to the general manager.
Okay, so just to be super clear here, your motion
is to direct
the general manager to sign this contract
for a 10-year term.
10 years.
Based on the Addendum D being filled out, that line 5 shall say 0 to 750, and that line 7 shall say 0 to 1,314,000. That we ask the general manager to request in writing clarification that we are not required to sell them energy. That's my motion.
And then for 10 years?
10 years.
And if we are able to get a clarification inserted into this contract as approved by MCE regarding the definition of product as not including resource allocation.
Adequacy.
And that's not contingent on approving this, right? That's just something that we're going to hopefully get through another way.
But that would be a revision to this, so I want to make sure we get this on there. And that defines or clarifies that the definition of product refers solely to excess energy and its green attributes, right? Okay.
You have adequate direction, Jason.
Okay. So we have a motion.
I made the motion.
We don't need to vote.
Yes, we do. Yes, we have to vote by
Is there a second?
Is it an action item?
He's just approving an agreement contingent on these provisions.
Yeah, so yeah, just make those. We need to vote.
Is there a second?
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Certainly. Chair first?
Yes.
Mary Beth Bushy?
No.
Dean DiGiovanni?
Yes.
Michael Borstein?
Yes.
Doug Kelly?
Yes.
And Dan Hilmer?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a long, difficult discussion. And Mary Beth, I hear you, and I really value your opinion, and you've been very helpful on this. So even though you didn't vote for it, I appreciate you trying to improve it as much as possible.
I think we found a common ground. So
thank you.
That was enough to get it through. Now let's see how fast we go through the rest of it.
Yeah. All right.
We can do it really fast.
Agenda item 8.
I'm not going to go through that on any other items, Mary Beth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where you drag us through that.
I'm sorry. Now.
I'm not going to do that ever again.
To our consultants, really appreciate it.
So talk tomorrow with Ryan.
Thank you,
Ryan.
Thank you for walking us through that.
Okay, agenda item number 8, new laboratory analyst job description. Jason?
Yeah, just real brief. There's a lot of background and memo here, but essentially we went to the finance committee as part of the revenue plan, and we presented a couple options regarding how the agency can apply with new environmental laboratory accreditation requirements. And we reviewed hiring a new staff person, a lab analyst, or amending our contract with our contract laboratory to perform all of our regulatory analyses. Looked at the costs. The low-cost option was to hire another laboratory analyst. And then once we have our laboratory certified to meet the new ELAB requirements, there's a possibility that then we could be the certified laboratory for the smaller agencies in the Marin that don't have the resources to meet those new ELAB requirements. So the finance committee thought that was a fine recommendation. They selected that. They asked us to include funding for that in the 5-year revenue plan, which we've done. And so the first step in this is for the board to approve this new job description for the laboratory analyst and the 5-step compensation range. This is a represented position by SEIU Local 1021, so we provided the lab analyst job description to them. They didn't have any comments on the job description. They asked how the salary was defined, so we explained that, and they accepted that. So we're recommending you approve the job description and the compensation range.
Now, we have just recently passed a resolution about how we approve salary increases.
That's right,
Do you think new positions should come back for a second vote under a consent calendar? Do you think it would not fall under that? And is it time of the essence on this one?
It could be a 2-step process or a single-step process. The reason we propose single-step, because that is a new job description, and the salary range is between existing salary ranges, and we're not making any adjustments to compensation and benefits for any other classifications at the agency.
Thank you. Good. Any questions?
The job description was passed on to the union representative?
Yes.
With no objection?
That's correct.
Any other questions?
And that this was included in an identified in our budget.
In the 5-year revenue plan.
Yes.
And we assumed that we would, have a new staff person, in the beginning of the fiscal year, in July sometime.
Okay.
Yeah, because I just want to bring that up for the rest of the board, because I remember seeing that and questioning it a couple meetings ago. And for the sense of having seen it a couple times now, it's been discussed at this level.
Thank you. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak to this? Seeing none. I'll bring it back for further discussion, questions. If not, how about a motion?
I recommend we approve the laboratory lab analyst job description and compensation range.
Second.
May we please have a roll?
Yes. Chair first?
Yes.
Mary Beth Bushy?
Yes.
Dean DiGiovanni?
Yes.
Michael Borstein?
Yes.
Doug Kelly?
Yes.
And Dan Hilmer?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Financial policy, this is agenda item number 9, financial policy number 555, multi-year revenue plan. What's the timing on this one? Because we are...
This is vast.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so this is just a follow-up activity from last month's board meeting where the board approved the guiding principles as revised for the development of a revenue plan. And part of that discussion was to take the guiding principles and integrate those into an agency financial policy. So after the meeting, we looked at the financial policies, didn't cleanly fit into anything, so we just drafted a new financial policy that includes the guiding principles. And that's what's attached to the staff report, so our recommendation is to approve the multi-year revenue planning financial policy.
Any questions?
I spoke about this with Jason earlier this week.
Okay. Any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for discussion or a motion.
This has been revised and read to reflect what we discussed last time, so I would move accept this.
Approve it. Move to approve financial policy second. Number 5x5. And Doug, you second it. Thank you. Roll.
Chair First?
Yes.
Mary Beth Bushy?
Yes.
Dean DiGiovanni?
Yes.
Michael Borstein?
Yes.
Doug Kelly?
Yes.
And Dan Hilmer?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Next up on the agenda is North Bay Watershed Association report. I attended on March 2nd. It was held at the Marin Municipal Water District facility. First up, Jerry Merrill, former Deputy Director of the California Department of Water Resources, spoke about a state water bond that will be on the November ballot. Although there's some question about whether it might be June, but I think it's November. It was really interesting about all the different kinds of things that are in this. Things like watersheds, habitats, stormwater, fisheries. There are 18 separate state agencies which will be administering the funds. For more information, waterbond.org. By the way, one quick fact that I found shocking is that 1 million people do not have adequate access to safe drinking water and or wastewater systems in California. For example, North Coast oftentimes does not have adequate wastewater systems. There's lots of support for the water bond. Evidently, the Sierra Club opposes. There is a project in the bond listed. It's a major rehab project for a canal in Kern County, and Sierra Club fears that that would include a new dam on that particular river. Krishna Kumar, general manager of MMWD, spoke. He said two biggest issues for MMWD, water supply and dam safety. MMWD was the first municipal water district in California, founded in 1912. They have 245 employees, 62,000 connections, serving 187,000 people. And I'm sure there's lots more information you can probably get on their website. They also have 130 miles of hiking trails and 73 miles of biking trails.
Everyone knows 60 of those.
Okay, there you go. The water supply, 73% of it comes from local supplies. 25% is imported from Sonoma County. 2% is recycled from Las Colinas. There was also a presentation by Michael Bann, the Environmental and Engineering Services Manager, about dam safety that was very interesting. And also a presentation by Greg Andrew, MMWD Fisheries Manager, and two of his staff talking about salmon and winter habitat and such. Try to make that quick. Michael, you have anything to add?
No, it's really interesting. Dam safety, especially in our community, because we have like 6 or 7 large dams.
Yep.
And Alpine Dam is over on.
Oh, we lost him. Okay, thanks for keeping it short, Michael.
I'm off adjourned.
Oral reports by commissioners, general manager. Any commission reports? General manager.
I have a handout for you. The only thing I'll point out here is that all the GPA revisions have been approved for the most part. We have a new draft 2018 GPA that's been published. The managers get together in a couple of weeks and take a look at the last final revisions. We're waiting on some minor additional language on the withdrawal section over at Ross Valley, so we'll see that pretty soon. And then SD2 has some language for the indemnification section to protect agencies from any penalties or fines due to MPS permit violations by other agencies. So we'll wait for that one, too. Hopefully we'll get both of these pretty soon.
And we're asking Larkspur to put this on their agenda, the item LAFCO brought up.
I've asked the
Lost Valley Sanitary District is.
Right? We took that. Okay.
Well, I think the thing is that the JPA is waiting for Larkspur, and Larkspur is waiting for the JPA, and it's a little circle, and it's just asking them to.
Okay.
They're on their agenda.
All right. Thank you all. Next scheduled meeting, remember, date change, April 12th, Thursday, 7 p.m.
Yeah, we moved that mirror before you came.
That's right.
All right.
Perfect.
Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.